You'll see him later. So we're only doing one song at the top of the show tonight because I want to get to some stories. So I've invited a bunch of people here who either I've traveled with before or I would love to travel with. Coming next to the stage, we have the other half of Rabbit Rabbit, former Nerdalogs member and also a wonderful storyteller and friend, Mr. Andrew Bentley.
Hello, I'm Andrew Bentley.
Gather ye round and I'll spin you a tale of the final journey of the Flying V. The Flying V was a red Volvo purchased in the early 90s and manufactured sometime before cars were actually invented. She was an aged vessel, but sturdy, and yes, I say she, no other gender would do, for she was mistress and mother both to such a rabble of awkward, gopping virgin men and sad boys that ne'er the world has seen their like again. Hearty lads we were and true, ripe for all manner of gamble and jape, transmuting with reckless alchemy our sexual frustration into fire, garbage, and regurgitated puddles of old granddad. Many the curbside was christened with vomit from the vantage of her passenger door. Many the parking lot tattooed with melted rubber. Her captain was a stalwart chap named Christopher Rorys, a name which has graced my stories before, usually in concord with some act of keen and abominable mischief. Our chariot in these triumphs was rarely other than the Flying V. We were graduated high school by the time the V entered our lives. Chris had not procured his driver's license until the age of 19, because he couldn't be bothered to take the practical exam or, if I'm being entirely honest, to learn how to drive. On his 19th birthday, he had simply strolled down to the DMV, answered a few questions about stoplights and three-point turns, and walked away with permission from the state of Virginia to hurl 3,000 pounds of rusted metal down her highways as fast as the vexing laws of physics would permit. I was but a month or so into college when the V made her first desperate plummet down I-95 to Christopher Newport University and fetched up on the shores of my dorm. Now, the unorthodox way in which Chris had outwaited the state for his license was well known to me, but I had no car and neither did my friends. Well, Rob had one, but he was rarely sober enough to find it, leaving aside operation. Worse yet, CNU was a dry campus. If we wanted to drink in circumstances somewhat louder or cheerier than Anne Frank's bat mitzvah, we had two choices. One, be much cooler than we actually were, or two, travel 20 miles up the road to William and Mary, where either the students were less cool, or we were granted enough exotic outsider charm that our coolness would only be undercut by the time it was too late to kick us out. My friend John was pledging a frat there, and the parties were plentiful. Well, technically, John was pledging the shadow of a frat. Their particular chapter had been disowned after the brothers threw a couch out a window and it landed on a girl's face. Their charter had been revoked, while the victim had suffered a broken nose and continued to date one of the brothers and make frequent appearances at their parties, like the ghost of Banquo in a tube top and Uggs. This was our Valhalla. And the Rainbow Bridge was 20 miles of forested highway traversable by no public transportation. And so, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man was our chauffeur, and we lavished our cyclops with fervent love. Throughout my freshman year, the V would appear on our campus with regularity, as red and as pregnant with the promise of celebration as the Kool-Aid man himself. With a proverbial, oh yeah, Chris would hurtle into the parking lot, burst through the wall of our tedium, and we would prostrate ourselves before him and sup from his prodigal bounty. This continued through the ice-slick roads of winter and the flooding rains of spring. Practice did not make perfect, at least not as most motorists would regard it, or pedestrians, or rhinoceri. Chris did not become a better driver in the normal sense of learning to obey the rules of the road. He became an expert at violating them. It's been said that Black Sabbath guitarist Tony Iommi was such a unique guitarist because, not in spite of, his maimed hands. The Flying V was Chris's guitar. He knew her timing to an absolute fault. During breaks from school, back in our even more boring suburb, we would enlist the V in fun runs. Fun runs consisted of driving up and down the Fairfax County Parkway in the middle of the night, drinking in the back seat, and shooting bottle rockets onto the road from a tube braced against the passenger side view. Through the sunroof, our inebriates would shoot Roman candles. Chris knew how to gun the V at just the right moment so that when the skipping rocket exploded in the dark asphalt, we would plow right through it, showering our windshield with vibrant sparks. He could take an exit on a dime should the telltale flash of blue and red lights threaten to drown our reign of terror in entirely justified consequences. He wasn't a classical driver. He was jazz. It was the laws he didn't obey that made him a virtuoso. Like Werner Herzog's Grizzly Man, we eventually lost our advisable caution to the banality of habit. If you've seen Grizzly Man, you know how this analogy ends. One Saturday in April, a night like many before, five of us embarked on our oft-tread journey. It was a night of endings. Our last trip that year to John's frat, for one. For another, my friend Ryan would confide between his third and fourth beer that night that he hadn't been to class all semester and would definitely be expelled. And of course, the final voyage of the Flying V. What was different that night, I could not say. From my vantage in shotgun, Route 64 looked the same as ever, but something imperceptible must have shifted. Captain Rory's lunatic precision was short that crucial degree. That single inch between genius and madness was lost, and our vector shifted for the insidious reefs of the Virginia interstate system. Barely 5 minutes into the trip, Chris missed our exit. That is to say, a landlubber would term it missed. That was it, I said, pointing four lanes over to the right as the fast-approaching off-ramp. I assumed we would take the next exit and circle round. A less courageous man than Captain Rory's might well have. That coward might have looked and quailed and not slammed the car impossibly sideways, perpendicular to all previous momentum, across three lanes of unseen traffic and into the exit lane, with only the damned chorus of backseat penitents screaming in horror to herald or trumpet his flight through a non-Euclidean rift in reality. A man who believed in physics could not have made that exit. I swear it. His knowledge would have slowed him. His fear would have cut his hand and by it slain us all. Yet Captain Rory's made it with the same alacrity as a blind samurai splitting a reed. For what it's worth, he did use a turn signal. We could say nothing. None of us. Chris didn't notice. The only sound was the oblivious crooning of Ace of Base on the iPod hookup. One song ended, another began. We were silent. Minutes passed, and we cruised into Williamsburg. There was our turn, on the right. There was us, in the left lane. There was the speedometer, somewhere between 50 and the speed of sound. Wait, I thought. Don't tell him. We'll make a U-turn. I bit my tongue. Right here, said Brandon. No, I screamed. I'm sure I did. But our captain heard nothing over the roar of the ocean and the pound of his lion's heart. We made the turn. The Flying V did not slow, it simply turned, as if caught on the hook of a monstrous unseen reel, she howled into the single-lane residential street. She struck the curb and bounced, and Ryan was thrown against his door, and then the door was gone, open, and Ryan was gone, out there, outside. By God, he was outside the car, all but his leg and his hand, clutching my seat as he flapped in the wind like a pennant. I turned to him and looked into the eyes of a man who knew he was about to die. And then, as Newton demands, he returned. The momentum of our ricocheting shuttle deposited him inside. The door slammed shut behind him. Whoa, said Chris. The rest of the night is a blur, the specifics of its bacchanalia indiscernible from so many bloodshot brothers. Was it the night I got drunk and shaved all my pubic hair, or the night I got drunk and fell off a wall singing Chim Chimini, Chim Chimini? Who can say? It's unimportant. It's unimportant how we arrived home, as we did. Some vital fuel had sparked its last. The next year, I had friends with houses and friends with cars, and these things were vaccine to the wanderlust which had struck us as freshmen, almost struck us down. The age of the Flying V was over, and she would fly no more. Well, really, what happened was Chris learned to fucking drive, and going to the mall with him didn't necessarily mean you were dry-humping the Grim Reaper anymore. But with basic automotive skills, something was lost. That old red Volvo would forevermore be bound by the chains of terrestrial possibility. And while we would many times more venture to John's frat, they were magicless translations. Nevermore would they be blessed with the impossibility of mortal flight, or we ourselves with that same nobility, the doomed and desperate grace of the sea-tossed sailor, the proud and foolish crew of the Flying V. Thank you.
Everybody, that was tremendous. Oh my God, tremendous and horrifying. I'm glad you're alive. I do think there's something, like, I don't know if you guys have ever driven in Manhattan, but I think, like, you need a little bit of madness to drive in, like, the urban environment of New York City. But, oh, shit. That's going to be running through my head, too. I'm going to be super careful. Also, seatbelts don't work on my dog, so that's, like, another reason to drive really careful. Don't be sad. She'll be fine. She'll probably be fine, guys.